Cannabis Forum. A public service feature of KDKB Radio. Good evening and welcome to Forum on a Tuesday night, October the 12th, 1971. This is William Edward Compton, and tonight we are, I will use the word privileged, and I don't use the word lightly. We are privileged to have a gentleman in the control room who I've been familiar with for a couple of years since coming to Arizona, and have been tremendously impressed with what I've seen in that two-year time. I'm speaking of Mr. Paulo Soleri, who is known as an architect, archaeologist, philosopher, or a lot of other things, depending on who you're talking to. And a lot of different people seem to have a lot of different ideas as to who he is and what he's doing. And so we thought that maybe the best way to find out was invite him up and let him speak for himself, because we've managed over the past couple of weeks to talk to a lot of other people. Currently, a couple of things we might mention. The fact that the architectural vision of Paulo Soleri, which is an exhibit, is now showing at the Phoenix Art Museum, or now on display, I guess I should say, and it's a culmination of about 15 years of his life's work, something that we had the opportunity to look at this afternoon, and I would urge everyone to get down there. Also, something that will be coming up tomorrow night. Well, we'll just go ahead and talk about that later. First, we will say hello to Paulo, and good evening.
Hello.
How are you tonight?
Fine.
Are you?
Just about.
Just about. Okay. First, I would like to go ahead and start off by you telling the audience a little bit about you, something about your background.
Mm-hmm. I am Italian. I was born in Turin, which is an industrial town, a fairly sizable town for Italy. And I spent my life, the first part of my life, the school years there. I left Torino in, when I was 26 to come in this country, and exactly to be with Mr. Wright, Frank Lloyd Wright. I studied there in Torino, the School of Fine Arts, and then at the Polytechnic, I became an architect, a regular Italian architect. When I came in this country, I was about 18 months with Mr. Wright. Two seasons in Arizona.
How old were you at that time, Paulo, when you came?
26. 26, I think. So I had a certain background. I didn't come as young as many other students or apprentices. But I'm very glad I came to be with Mr. Wright, because it's quite an experience in many ways.
This is one thing that I think a lot of people have a misunderstanding about. And that is that a lot of people feel, or without being that familiar with your work, feel that you drew a lot of your ideas from Frank Lloyd Wright. And even though I realize that you probably did learn a lot from the man, you already had a lot of the things that you have been doing formulated at that time, a lot of the concepts.
More than, not so much concepts, but really the background, the cultural background, and the kind of environment that I grew up in. From an architectural point of view, it was quite important, because Italy has quite a good architectural tradition, in a way, or urban tradition, modern architectural. So that was very, very important, I think, and that remained with me up to today. And in a way, with Mr. Wright, there was a break, because he was a countryman, fundamentally.
Right.
So this was a point where I couldn't agree with his ideas. But at the time when I was there, I didn't really know exactly what I would be doing. I knew that things were not as I saw them, and I wanted to do something about them, but I didn't know what at that point.
Could you tell us a little bit about your impressions of America, for instance, before you came to the country, when you were still in Italy studying architecture, and then after you got to America?
It was very much maybe a romantic or a fantasy more than a reality. The only background I had really was, it was funny, was Jack London and Zane Grey.
Yeah, Zane Grey, right. Zane
Grey. I remember when I was in the teens, reading just about everything that Zane Grey ever wrote. So Arizona was some kind of a thing in mid-air. And I didn't, well, the influence of the American civilization was very important throughout the war. I mean, you know, it was a sudden explosion on the European continent of this new great power.
Americana.
And then the Hollywood, you know, influence, that was an impact that it's hard to evaluate. You know, the films from Hollywood were with us always, or even during the fascist era. So that's
interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, yes. So that was quite a, in a way, a very artificial, but in other ways, now I found quite realistic and telling thing about the American culture.
Could you tell us a little bit about your impressions of what the American civilization would be like, and then maybe what it was like, you know?
You mean how I felt when I came here?
Well, your initial impression,
yes,
of what, for instance, the urban cities,
mm-hmm,
would, what the urban, mm-hmm, centers would be like, and then when you came here and saw what they were like.
I didn't really think so much in terms of cities, because what attracted me was Frank Lloyd Wright, the anti-city man, and then the American landscape, frankly. That was probably the influence of Jack London and Zen Gee. So those were the two elements, more than you know, the feeling about the great cities, though I knew a little about New York, Chicago, San Francisco, New Orleans.
How did you picture those cities?
Oh, I can't tell
you.
I don't even remember, really. It's mostly, you know, from photographs and hearsay and some reading. So I couldn't really tell at this point. I don't remember, frankly.
And what was your impression when you got here and saw what New York was like, for instance?
I watched New York for 35 days from Ellis Island. And it was quite an experience, because visually it was quite an experience, really, because you would see, for instance, the sunset against the outline, the skyline of New York, which was really terrific. But then my experience was to be picked up by the police at the Ellis Island and taken in to be questioned in New York. So in those big cars, you know, you're not used in Italy with those enormous cars.
Right,
You get into the ferry boat, and then they put you in this enormous car and you drive through on the freeways, and you go out into a dingy street, and then, so that was an experience which wasn't exactly the great democratic,
the great American dream.
Yeah. But then I was in New York for a few days before I left, and that was an experience, really.
What did you think about the city itself, the way, from an architectural standpoint?
More than architecturally, that which somehow it was pretty raw and coarse, was the life, you know, the intense life and the turbulence and aggressiveness that you would feel just by walking throughout Manhattan. And when I speak of New York, I really speak of few blocks, because I don't really know New York much more than its own center, let's say.
You were telling me the other day that, for instance, the cities in Italy differed quite a bit, you know, the way the cities, mm-hmm, were laid out than the American cities. And you mentioned to me the other day that you had expected this very progressive direction in American cities, and when, mm-hmm, you got over here, it wasn't quite that way at all.
Yeah, probably San Francisco and New Orleans might have some elements in common with, let's say, the Italian cities, and maybe New Orleans more than San Francisco. Well, the Italian cities, the European cities, were really built, you know, for the persons, for the people, for the pedestrians.
Right.
So that they are like large living rooms in their own best aspects, outdoor living spaces. For the American city, this is not true. The outside is just a service kind of pattern that you follow in order to get somewhere. So the street has become the road, and while in Italy it used to be almost the playground and the place where you meet and where you promenade, you have your own social life partially outside of your quarters. which explains why we don't feel cramped or secluded in apartment houses, because part of the living room is downstairs where you meet with other people.
In other words, sort of the giant meeting room where all of the people can congregate and get together, etc.
Now, this is becoming less and less true even in Europe because of the injection of the traffic. And I think this is a great loss because it somehow defeats the purpose of transportation. Transportation should transport people to the centers of communal activity, of intercourse, of meeting. And what it does, it really segregates people more than connecting them.
What happened, how did you hear about Frank Lloyd Wright, for instance, to know that you wanted to come and study with the man?
Well, in each university, in each school of architecture, you would have a little library, and then naturally, as a student, you are trying to get information about what's happening in other countries, and we got some books about Frank Lloyd Wright just at the beginning of the war, and so we started to know about him, and in many ways, Frank Lloyd Wright was better known in Europe than in the States at that time.
That probably doesn't hold quite as true today as it did then. Because he's become, I guess, more famous over the past 15 or 20 years. When you came here, what do you think you gained in the year and a half that you spent studying with him that perhaps you didn't have before?
Maybe the greatest gain was the coherence of the environment that you were put in. In other words, no matter how you might judge the quality or the nature or the aim of the environment was... it has an integrity that it's very rarely found anywhere else. So this is a very important element, and it's really what we are missing in the environment, the integrity, the coherence, the trust, the goal for something, the seeking of something.
And as I understand Frank Lloyd Wright, and you probably understand it much better, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in his structures, he took into consideration the setting that they would be in, the environment that they would be in, and he built according to that, as opposed to building according to, we need a business building, so let's slap this thing up, you know. He did take some consideration for the type of activity that would take place in it, and also surrounding area. And is that what you gained?
Yes, the part of the integrity was this ability to become part of the landscape. And both places, Taliesin East in Wisconsin and Taliesin West in Paradise Valley, very striking examples of two ways of approaching the shelter and the life of man in two different environments.
What did you do after leaving the school, what were your plans at that time? Can you remember what your thoughts were?
No plans. I was at loss somehow, but I was helped by Mark Mills. It was one of the boys that left Taliesin with me. He was from Jerome. He is from Jerome. He's in Carmel now. We camped on Camelback at that mountain. At the time, there was hardly anything there. And we did some work for a real estate. I was drafting some ideas for houses for him. Then I did a competition for my town, the Polytechnic, the new Polytechnic competition. And then we started building this dome house in Cape Creek for the lady that became my mother-in-law. And after we built the house, we got married and with my wife, and we left for Italy for about 5 years.
You spent 5 years over in Italy again?
Yeah.
And what did you do in those 5 years?
We were in Turin for a while. A colleague got acquainted with my family. And we had the first child, Christine. And then we moved south with the intention of finding a place where we could learn a craft, because by then I decided that I wouldn't make a living by commissions in architecture. So I was trying to get to find out what kind of craft activity could I get into and make a living out of it. So we ended up in Vietri, which is a small town with a number of families producing ceramics. And we got involved with one of the families, and they asked us to build a factory. So we built a ceramics factory there. And at the same time, I learned some of the skills in ceramics
that you have since put to use in
then
in your school.
When we came here, we started doing ceramics. Later on, we got into the metal.
Now, when you came back to the States after the 5 years. Did you come to Arizona initially?
We tried Santa Fe for one summer, but I intended to work outdoor. So we were doing ceramics outdoor, and very often at night it would freeze in the middle of August. So that was it. I couldn't accept that. So we moved in Paradise Valley.
And is that the present location?
We bought a little house, which was one of the few houses in Paradise Valley then. And then a few years later, I was doing ceramics on the spot. We had a fire in a pump house where I was doing my ceramics. So we built a shed, and then from the shed we moved into more permanent structures. And so we've been building ever since.
So what sort of ceramics were you doing at that time?
We were slip casting in molds cut into the ground. And we were doing bells because that was the marketable item.
And
bells.
It's still the thing
you're
doing.
It still is. It's a very good supporter of the foundation.
That's one thing that sort of amazes me when I talk to people who live outside this area. And that's the fact that a lot of people are familiar with who you are, but they are familiar with you due to your bells rather than due to a lot of your ideas. And I think that's kind of unusual. Maybe you should include a pamphlet with each of your bells.
We are doing that now. We are very slow at that, but we are doing that now. But now is the moment when those two things get together and they help each other. I have been waiting for this moment for a long time. Finally, the thing is clicking.
Now, when you after you started getting into the ceramics, when did you start coming into the type of ideas that you have that you seem to have been coming into over the last 15 years or so about the kinds of structures that you wanted to build and things of this nature, your school, for instance?
I was spending part of my time in investigating things on the environmental field. I was doing sketches and reading and so on. And then I got a grant from the Graham Foundation in Chicago for a study for an urban center. So that gave me enough means to develop an idea and get some help from young people. Then I got a second grant from the Guggenheim, another grant from Guggenheim, and then a second grant from the Guggenheim, and that, as a product of those three grants, I ended up with the MIT book, The Ecologies. And the last 5 years or six have been the years where I developed the archaeological concept, which is what I'm involved now in the building phase even.
Could you tell us a little bit about the school, how that came about, and how it's grown from its initial?
Well, when I was in Taliesin, I felt that one of the very positive things about it was that you had a family life enmeshed into a larger activity, which was the fellowship activity. So I felt that was very good, very positive and enriching. So I decided then that I would have liked to have something of that sort. It took many years to get into it, but slowly we built up the means and way of attracting young people to come and be apprenticed or be participant in what we are doing.
And how did you go about that? For instance, how does it differ now from when you initially started the school?
Oh, I started with one boy from Oklahoma, a young architect. He was there for 3 years almost all by himself, working with me. And then with the grants coming, we got some students, ex-students, three or four at the time, from different areas. One was Ivan Pintar, which is still with me, with us. And then slowly we got involved with the university, with the College of Architecture in Tempe, and they were sending us students from all over the country in short workshops, 6 weeks in the middle of the summer. We did that for many years, the seal pile workshops. And then about 3 years ago, we enlarged the activity. We went into five workshops, and this year we had 11. And we are involving about 300 people this year in this building and construction workshop.
In other words, in the last 7 years, you've gone from one to about 300 students.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so
Let's say last 10 years.
10 years. You've done very well, I think,
Well, it could have been better, but I am not complaining.
One thing that that sort of amazes me about you is the fact that most of the things that you have done through your school and through your work and everything have been basically on an individual basis. And it doesn't seem that you go out of your way, for instance, to get grants from people, or you don't seem to go out of your way to try to pull federal money into your projects, and you seem to sort of enjoy working more on your own. And
if I were more skilled in getting help, I would go about it. But I'm very poor at it, so I feel I waste my time really in doing those things. So now and then I try, but it's never a sound or a positive. They will come around probably. Now they are starting to watch, because I'm not just talking. I'm starting to do it. And at the beginning, there was a feeling of I was some crazy guy in the desert digging holes. Now I'm a crazy guy with some crazy theories, but those theories are becoming accepted. So there people start to read about and listen. Once we get something going on in terms of bricks or mortar or concrete, they will come and look, and then at that point someone might decide that there is something very positive there.
I think one of the reasons that you're finding more acceptance toward your theories and your ideas would perhaps be the renewed interest in the ecology of the planet and the state of our environment. I think that's probably a great deal of it.
Yeah, that was a real coincidence. I don't know if it was fate or providence or what, but my book came out just in time, and the large exhibit, which is at the museum now in Phoenix, was ready just about when the ecology bomb exploded. So that was, as you said, very timely.
One thing that a lot of people don't realize is that you've been working in the ecological directions for years and years and years now, rather than, you know, just over the past. Like most people, for instance, myself, have a consciousness of ecology mm-hmm. that has been developed over the last couple of years, whereas it seems to be a concept that you've been working toward for quite a few years.
Yeah, I was always a little surprised how little the architects were interested in an environmental problem in a large sense, you know, the connection between the man-made and the natural. And this was always, I couldn't understand that. So I was involved in that.
Perhaps 15 years ago, did you see some of the problems, or did you foresee some of the problems that have arisen over the past 5 years, let's say, across the world?
In fact, in the Mesa City project, there is an element which indicates that I have a recycling belt which surrounds the city, sunken in the ground, because it's not the nicest thing you can work with or look at. But this is a recycle plant that takes everything that the city rejects, from garbage to waste to used up equipment, and recycles them into raw products or energy or fertilizer or whatever is the cycle. Because one of the problems that we are finally facing now is that all the cycles we open remain open, and that's what pollution is, an open cycle.
Right. Now, one of the things that that I wanted to get into are definitions of some words, because I know that a lot of people, for instance, never even stop to think what a city really is, you know. They know that they live in one, and they know that there are a lot of things available to them there, but they really have no concrete definition, and I think that you've taken some steps in defining some terms that that I would, for instance, what do you see a city as?
Well, you could see it on two levels. One is what I call the instrumental level, which means it's that kind of large instrument that allows people to work together, to cooperate toward a certain environment which is going to enrich each participant. And this environment is the cultural environment that you can find only in the city. The instrumental level involves all the servicing, all the elements that makes the physical life of the city possible, from delivery of everything to the retrieval of everything. But if the city stops there, it's very questionable the validity of it. The city must go far beyond it, and that's where you get into the social and cultural aspects. So the city must be a center of culture and civilization.
And the city really has no point in existing outside of for those reasons, does it?
Yes, because it has a point, but it's a point that somehow takes the city at the to the level of the beehive or the termite, what do you call it, nest, or anything that has social aspects but is deprived of the cultural aspects, which are the aspect that really makes man what he is.
And what is that?
Well, the more you move into the stuff that makes man what it is, the more difficult is the definition, because we know very well that you cannot define God, you cannot define beauty, you cannot define sentiments, you cannot define emotion and all those things. So it's very difficult to say what culture is or what is the sap that makes culture into the city, but it's felt very strongly when the city is cultured. And but there are institutions that are suggesting what it is: institutions of learning, institutions of play, institutions of exchange of ideas. And they go from the written word, the spoken word, the written word, to visual aspects, including television and radio and so on.
I need to come in at this point and say it's 7:30, and that you're listening to KDKB FM Stereo in Mesa, and we are in the process of talking to Mr. Paulo Soleri about, and we're finally working into some of his theories. Now, in the last 60 or 70 years in the United States, we've seen this country, which is a rather large country, mm-hmm. grow from being a very rural type nation into mm-hmm. to an urban nation. Do you feel that perhaps a lot of the problems that we are experiencing in the cities, we are experiencing because of the rapid growth that we've seen over the past half century?
Definitely. And and this is compounded by the number, by the population, by the vastness of the territory involved, by the different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, and by technology, which is it can do the most for us or the least. It can be good or can be evil, as depending on what the use is that we make of. So most of the ills of this country are the ills of probably of youth in many ways. Youth complicated by this shrinking of the time schedules. We are dealing constantly with the shrinkage of time, which means more things happen in shorter time slots.
But that adolescent growth could very well put us into a life and death type situation, couldn't it?
Yes, because of number and because of power, we are now we are peculiarly apt at destroying ourselves, but also at making ourselves in something, if not godlike, very, very exciting and very exhilarating. It depends on us, though.
Do you think that, what do you think are the main problems, for instance, in American cities today? And we'll take those as a specific.
Well, I would say the same problem that is in American society. I would say materialism is a very tough problem.
Could you expand on that?
Well, we are finding out that affluence is not such a blessing. And we're finding out that it's not such a blessing because affluence tends to desensitize more than what we were expecting. So instead of making people more sensitive to environment, to other people, to the institutions that we have invented, we see that people tends to withdraw or just to enjoy what we call the comfort of a certain environment and ignore things which are far very, very important.
Such as?
Such as the ability to seek new things, to not to be satisfied of what there is, the ability to enjoy things of a more subtle quality, which means in general that we tend to alt or to reverse the process of life, which is the going from matter into spirit. And if materialism is something, is this reversal, so that we achieve a certain point of affluence that I call opulence, and this condition seems to be stopping this progression toward the spirit.
I think that one reason that could be true is it seems that the more affluent one gets, the more one has to pursue one's affluence. You know, it's not a situation where people are able to attain something, and they're. It seems that most of the people I've known who were striving to be affluent, mm-hmm. let's say, were people who said, I want to be affluent because it's going to afford me a large amount of time so that I'll be able to devote mm-hmm. myself to all of these, really spiritual interests mm-hmm. is what they boil down to. But it never seems to quite happen that way. They always, it's another cycle that they seem to get hung up in because you have to pursue it to continue.
And that seems that... nobody knows really exactly why. It seems that the driving force that society had at a certain point is disappearing, and we have a breakdown. And when there are no goals really to go after, goals which are beyond the individual and the personal and strictly self-centered, opulence is the best thing to do. Let's get rich or semi-rich or... safe and comfortable, and that's it.
In other words, let's pad our existence from all of these mm-hmm. other things around us mm-hmm. that we don't want.
Yeah, and now we're finding out that this is not only too self-centered to be really meaningful, but it's also very dangerous and very destructive.
Do you think that you hear a lot of talk about the population explosion, for instance, and on one side you have people, for instance in this country particularly, who say, well, actually the birth rate of the United States is decreasing and there is no population problem in this country, and on the other hand you have people who say, well, if we don't start doing something about the population, then by 1980 or by the turn of the mm-hmm. century, we're going to find ourselves in a position where there are people starving and where we...
And the other one is to introduce the third dimension, which means, in a way, let's say, take a town like Phoenix, cut it in blocks, and then take each block and put it on top of the next. Now, it sounds very ridiculous to explain this way, but because you need a rearranging, really, of many, many things when you do that. But by doing this, you make of Phoenix a miniature of itself, which means you really put each city dweller in Phoenix at the center of the city.
Now, I know a lot of, on some of your structures, they've been spoken of being, for instance, 1 mile square and very, very tall. Mm-hmm. And so you build, vertically, I suppose you would say.
Yes. The reason for that is that if you consider how we perform in our daily lives, you see that the performance demands only about 10 feet in height, while it demands very large areas horizontally. So when you try to connect those areas horizontally, you get in troubles. When you try to connect them vertically, because you're able to pile them up, then you see immediately how swift the connection becomes. Not only that, but there is something peculiar about the difference, in the difference between the car behavior mode and the elevator mode. The car needs the road. The road becomes a divider, a separating element. It becomes a segregative element. The elevator is able to do the same thing far better, much faster and economically without separating, because it perforates through the performances instead of separating them, cutting into them and separating them. So I really think that the answer, the instrumental answer and the logistical answer to the problem of the cities is a congruence between the horizontal dimensions and the vertical dimension.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned to me the other day when you were talking was, for instance, that each person would have, let's say, an apartment somewhere in the city.
Yeah.
And what would be the normal living space that would be appropriated to one person?
It would depend very much on the nature of the society that you are trying to serve. If you're serving an Indian New Delhi, evidently you have a certain space that this person needs,
right,
because of his background. If you're serving a New Yorker, it's another space. If you serve a Los Angelinos, it might have to be a different space.
In other words, your cities. One of the things I think that this is one thing I was noticing today when you were giving your lecture. A lot of people felt that all of your cities would look the same. You know, that they would all, you would say, well, this is the design, you know, and we will take this design and we'll
and
put
multiply.
It in Phoenix and we'll put it in New York and we'll put it in Hong Kong and we'll put it so and so and so and so. And you explained at the time that geographically in the first place, you could not build the same type of city mm-hmm. in each place. Mm-hmm. I believe one of the instances you gave was that, for instance, some cities would be too heavy to build in some areas mm-hmm. of the country. And could you explain that to us, how you would go about deciding what type of city to build in each area?
Yeah, the work I have done up till now was to develop a concept, let's say, based on this little discovery that complexity has to deal with liveliness, and you have complexity only when you are able to gather things, which means somehow miniaturize things. And then around this, let's say, discovery, I worked out some inventions in very abstract terms, and those are the material of the MIT book. Those are examples, very abstract examples, of some of the developments that could be made for different kinds of situations, for small urban centers, large urban centers, and anything in between. So those 30 diagrams, which is what they are, they're not blueprints. They don't try to say, this is a ready-made city, you just build it, and like a set of blocks that you assemble. Those are attempt to illustrate the concept. Now, if a commission came, evidently it would be for a specific problem. So you would have to get into the problem and find out what the needs are, and then with as much knowledge as you can, and now how much know-how that you can gather around yourself, you go about the problem, which means that each commissioned archaeology would have a very different aspect because of the social background, because of the geographic, topographic, geological, climatological, et cetera, aspects of it.
This is one economic thing. Thing that I find that you differ in a lot of other architects that at least I've talked to, and that's that you seem to take a lot of different things into account when you are thinking of building a structure or planning a city. You know, you do take into account the social background. You do take into account a lot of the cultural aspects mm-hmm. that other architects seem to ignore. Do you think that this is perhaps some of the problem that we've run into in our cities, the fact that we have considered things strictly from an architectural standpoint and not from a social mm-hmm. standpoint?
Well, I must say right now that it's easy to say, you know, they are taking care of this, this, and this, but it's very difficult to do. So I'm not pretending that to say that I know those things, so I'm going to take care of them. But
I'm not setting you up as an authority on
I know that the problem, the urban problem, is in a way the most complex problem we are faced with, because it's so inclusive. It includes the person, it includes the society, it includes the institutions, it includes the environment, the pollution, the waste, everything. So that demands the inclusion in the project phase of as much know-how as you can get. At the same time, just because it's so complex, you cannot simulate it, because you can simulate only problems of which you have knowledge of all the parameters. So you go to the moon, you simulate the moon trip, you know the gravitational laws, astronomy gives you all the data you need, the physics, so that you don't even need to do the trip itself. You just get your machines going and you simulate it. Well, this is not feasible when you're dealing with the human spirit, let's say, to take the most non-simulable kind of stuff. So that you must have enough courage to decide that at a certain point of in your study, in your development, in your collection of data, in your simulation, that you have to go beyond it and you have to verify, which means you have to build and then check. And this is expensive.
This is one of my questions. Is this, you've told me some of your reasons behind the model city that you're building, but is this one of the reasons, the fact that you are, this is the first step in seeing exactly what it would be like?
Oh yeah. There is, it comes a moment when talking about something or writing about something or collecting mountains of data becomes somehow a nonsensical, I think. Especially now when the problems are so immediate. So you have to get into the pragmatic condition and do your best.
Now, you have sort of termed, or coined a term, archaeology. And I was wondering if you might give us a definition of that particular word.
Yeah, it was trying to connect, and just happened that the ecological fashion came about, connect ecology and architecture. So architecture should be an activity that involves the environment of man. So arcology, it stands, symbolizes this fusion of the environment and the natural environment and the man-made environment.
I need to come in at this point and say this is KDKV FM Stereo in Mesa, and we are talking to Mr. Paulo Soleri, arcologist, we will call him at this point. It's very difficult to figure out what to call somebody, Paulo. You end up having to reel off, you know, because man is a complex animal. You have to reel off all of these descriptive terms, so we'll just say that and let it go there. How did you go about deciding that you wanted to do it, and when did you decide, well, now is the time that I want to do it, et cetera? Could you just tell us a little bit about how the Model City came
about?
Well,
those things happen, you know, in time. You feel a certain way, a certain point, and you feel a certain frustration, and you decided what you're doing is really important enough to demand for a greater effort. And slowly you convince yourself that you must do something about moving from the theory, from the paper, into the reality. And this fact, plus the fact that we were developing a certain power of attraction to not only young people, but to people, made me decide that I might as well go about it and try to build something, even if it sounds foolish and foolhardy.
It's a word. And when exactly did you start building the city?
Well, 3 years ago, we got hold of the land, which is about 4 square miles that we control, the foundation, the Kozani Foundation, and we are still buying the land. We have 860 acres that we own, and 3,200 acres that we lease, a government lease.
Where is it located?
It's at Cordes Junction, east of Cordes Junction, and it's a little ranch. It's quite a beautiful piece of land. It has the Agua Fria River cutting through a little canyon. We have some farmland. We have power, water, access road. And last year we set up a little camp as a base camp, and this year we are starting the building itself. We are trying to keep visitors away from it because we are really trying to get set up.
And it's very difficult, I know, in the initial stages to get things done and explain what you're doing at the same time. How many people do you have up there working at the present time?
We have about between 60 and 70 people from March until the middle of November. But this involves really about 300 different persons, because most of them come for about 6 weeks workshops.
And they come in groups of 60 or 70?
No, the workshops overlap. That's why we have two groups always present there. So the groups are between 25 and 35 each. So they sum up to about 60. And then we have a certain number of staff members that are keeping the continuity and the know-how somehow.
Now, do you draw those people who are working on it from the architecture students who come to study under you?
No, at this point they really come as they happen to find out about the work, and they write, and we send them a certain information material, including an application form. So if they get interested, they apply for it, and then we establish a date, and they come.
How do you go about choosing the people who will be the people?
In a way,
that you
the selection is a negative selection, in the sense that we put fairly stiff demands on them with this information package.
What sort of demands?
Well, we are telling them that they mustn't believe that they come in a city. They are going to come to begin the building of a small town, so they are pioneering. They are in the wilderness, the facilities are minimal and primitive. Second, they have to work hard, because the premises are that we are going to build something for the use of a certain society that of which they might be part later on. So they're not to come there to find a society, nor to find the facilities for the society. They come there to begin this process. They have to work 7.5 hours a day. They have to pay in order to work. So it's a pretty stiff demand.
In other words, the people who really do come are the people who are very interested in you.
Oh, yes.
Do you run into situations where you have to weed people out very often?
Very rarely. That doesn't mean that it's easy, because for one, I'm not a sociable person. I tend to be introverted, if anything. And then the demands we are putting on them are quite demanding. And many of the people that come are not used to physical labor, for instance, especially many of the girls. We have quite a number of girls. The conditions are, though the land is beautiful, the conditions are not the easiest, because we have hot weather, cold weather, rain, wind, and so on and on. But things are working out. We are learning quite a bit.
Could you tell us a little bit about the city itself? What the structure will be like, what sorts of things will be mm-hmm. available inside, mm-hmm. and et cetera?
Well, it's really going to be a minimal city. We should call it a town, really. And it's going to be about 3,000 people, if it's ever going to be completed. And it occupies 1% of the land that we have, which is a very important point. It's 10 acres. Of the 860 acres, we use only 10 acres for the building. The remaining is at the disposal of the dwellers. It's going to be an average of 26 or so floors, but some part of it goes higher than that. It's so small that you practically don't need any transportation system inside. You just walk. There are elevators, naturally, throughout the building. And you are, wherever you live your private life, you're in contact with the inside and the outside. So that you participate in both the outer life, the country life, and the whatever city life you might have there in a very minimal way. And we intend to put the accent on research, because the experiment itself is an inquiry on a possible alternative to the urban sprawl and to the urban tangle and problem that we are faced now. So you are working out your theories, and you're becoming some kind of a guinea pig for it. And you will really verify what you are talking about, and you're paying for it.
This is one thing that, how do you draw the funds for instance, for this city? This is, do you have any idea how much it's going to cost you to build this town?
A very, very vague idea. If you put the price tag on about $10,000 per person, which means not just living quarters, but the facilities that the utilities of the city can give in terms of social and cultural aspects, that for 3,000 people would be 30 million. But I think that's a little conservative or optimistic, if you want to. But
is that why you said, if the city ever gets built?
Yeah.
When you were speaking a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you have any doubts that it will?
Well, I don't like to be, too optimistic. But at the same time, I don't have any doubts that we are going to carry on the process we have now and possibly make it larger and larger every year, so that as we are dealing now with few hundreds of people, maybe within 5 years we are dealing with few thousands of people, which means that we are going to increase the productivity and the results that now are only beginning to be visible.
What sorts of social and cultural things will there be in the city available to the people there?
Well, as it is going to be in a way like a campus, because it involves a high percentage of young people, and this is because the young people are in a way more available for this kind of experience. They are the ones that can afford a certain time and money expense, and also they are very interested because it might be part of their own future. Being in a way the accent on young people is going to be very much of a campus-like life. But at the same time, we would like to involve, and in fact, we are going to try to put feelers into communities of elderly, because one thing I think we can do is to take care, in a way, of the geriatric problem, which is now very sad in many ways.
I agree with you there. It seems as though we've almost isolated old people into parks in their homes, you know.
So we would like to have elderly people that are willing to work with young people and somehow give their own wisdom or skills to the community. And I think they might find that very rewarding, because we have bright people around and very willing to work. And it's nice to have, you know, a community where you have all ages involved actively and with hope and some kind of goal to work toward.
How do you go about financing a project like this?
This is going to make you laugh. Until the payment for the land is completed, which is going to be next year, we are only able to use the money, the fee money that the students are bringing in. That means that whatever we do in materials, equipment, and know-how, and energy, is through this fee. So this is a minimal amount of cash. To this you have to add the performance of the students themselves. So it's not just the cash, but it's the labor that those young people are bringing in. And
I imagine it would be impossible to put a price tag on that, on the labor that they do themselves. I mean, there's no telling how much money it would cost you to get that done if you were to hire professional people to come in.
So that's one of the assets. Naturally, that's not going to be sufficient. But if it is, if it comes to be only that, we are going to go on that way, which means we are going to go very slowly. But so what?
That's one thing that doesn't seem to bother you, and that's one thing I find sort of admirable about you: the fact that there have been blocks set in your way, you don't seem to mind particularly. You may mind, but it doesn't stop you from continuing on.
Yeah, it's not that you don't mind, but there is no point in getting yourself tangled up in frustrations and desperation, and it doesn't build into anything. So you might as well do the best with what you have and go on from there.
Have any, for instance, governmental figures or people who might be able to help you in the financial aspect of the town approached you or shown any interest in it?
Yes, a number of people have shown interest, but for the moment it's verbal interest. As I was saying at the beginning, it's going to take a little more hardware on the spot to convince people that we are really going about it seriously. This is not a whim or a joke or a pastime. This is a serious thing. We have many lives involved in this, including my family's life. And we had to sacrifice many things in order to do this, but I'm lucky that both my wife and our children are very, very willing to do that. So there's no problem there. And we tend to have very small needs as far as persons. So our lives are very simple. This is a good attraction for the young people, because they see that we are doing what we are preaching in a way. So I think institutions or people or the government see that something that is going on, no matter the indifference that might be around, I think they're going to come around and help.
Do you find it sort of strange that you had to undertake this, not you, mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. you as an individual, but that one would have to undertake something like this on an individual basis in the face of all of the problems that seem to be in front of this country at the particular time? Do you find it a little strange that perhaps the government isn't doing its mm-hmm. own experimenting and building its own experimental cities and trying to come to some answers of their own?
Yeah, I find it strange, but that somehow connects to my theory that the most practical human being, which is the American, you know, pragmatic man, finds itself at this point in a very silly position, which is that the practical civilization is becoming unrealistic and utopian in a very central sense.
Can I read a quote from the New York Times?
Mm-hmm.
It really follows that well. It's done by, I believe her name is Ada Louise Huxtable.
Yeah.
This is an age that only recently ceased to discredit its intellectuals and still distrusts ideas. It's a society that has enshrined pragmatism and subjects every thought and action to the decisive test question, is it practical? Based on whether or not it is practical, we have built our world. One practical decision after the other has led to the brink of cosmic disaster, and there we sit in pollution and chaos, courting the end of the earth. And just how practical can you get? I thought that was a really interesting opening to to some of your theories.
Well, we discussed that. You know, she came to the exhibit, and we discussed that. And I have my, you know, I make a distinction, a sharp distinction between practicality and reality. And I feel that most of the time, when we are very practical, we are very unreal. And I know, not in a pragmatic sense, not in an idealistic sense.
But in a realistic sense, in a day-to-day living sense, we
yeah,
are.
Yeah, we are really losing track of the bulk of reality by becoming so practical about details. And this is evident, I mean, at this point.
One of the criticisms, if I might be able to bring up some criticisms concerning your ideas on city planning and things, is that the human being would lose a great deal of his privacy in being subjected to a very communal atmosphere, mm-hmm. like your city would be. How do you feel about that?
I feel very strongly because I feel that privacy is absolutely fundamental. We must be able, at any point of our daily life, to be as private as we want and as public as we want. So the two things are not exclusive. In fact, you can really be, let's say, public when you know that you can retreat in your privacy and vice versa. So in order to have both of them, you have to serve both of them very well. And this is feasible. In fact, it's one of the very important aspects of the ecology.
How would you go about this? How would you, Americans seem to be in some ways even more private than other mm-hmm. peoples of the world, and mm-hmm. definitely they're a lot more indignant about anyone mm-hmm. trespassing on their
yeah.
privacy. How would you go about safeguarding that?
Well, in very physical terms, there is a certain gate, let's say, or a door, or a separating elements that puts a boundary between the public and the private. And this doesn't have to be the door to your apartment. It can be the door to your house or to your home, because you can build a very large mansion instead of on the ground or a certain level. So it's not exclusively an apartment living, which for many people might not be attractive. It's a living at different levels. And this has its own advantages, besides the fact that it connects everybody to the center of the city, as I was saying, has advantage, for instance, of giving you a sweeping view of the landscape, which is a great, I think, spiritual asset. It allows you to look not into the backyard of somebody else, but into the backyard of nature, let's say, into the front yard of nature.
This is something we were talking about the other day, about how Americans seem to be building, you know, 9-foot fences now
mm-hmm.
to protect
mm-hmm.
their privacy, as opposed to
mm-hmm.
really doing something so that they can. I think what I'm trying to get at is that Americans seem to approach privacy very much on a physical aspect and very rarely on a mental or a social.
There is one thing that points at that, and it is that we have a great pride and a great effort is put in this country to make everyone the possessor and the holder of a number of physical things, the hardware that surrounds the American housewife or the American man. It's incredible, the hardware and the energy needed to run the hardware. And then when we move into the mental, we see that we become more and more collectivized. I think it should be the opposite. We can collectivize the physical, because it's just an instrument, it's not the meaning of life. And if we collectivize the physical, chances are we are going to find more freedom for the mental.
I think there are a number of examples that you can use for that. Number one, government encroachment would be, I guess, about the easiest, you know, the easiest thing to swing at.
Mm-hmm.
For
mm-hmm.
instance, you know, wiretapping, you know, all of the different things that we've seen mm-hmm. come into being over the mm-hmm. last 10 years that didn't exist before. And the fact that there always seem to be people in your neighborhood who are more than willing to want to know what's going on in your home and things. But do you feel that perhaps, I think government encroachment would be a very good example, do you feel that perhaps one of the reasons that governments have taken that step is due to the fact that the cities have become so spread out and it's so hard
to keep things together, yes.
That they feel that it's necessary,
mm-hmm.
because otherwise they wouldn't know what was going on.
In a way, bureaucracy feeds upon itself and administration feeds upon itself. So the more you need a large bulk of organizational systems, the more those systems are going to become larger. So what we have to do is to try to find a way of reversing the process, make bureaucracies into minimal systems, so that they become really quick in their own reaction, and the responses are going to be commensurate to the needs. And in order to do this, you have to set up more efficient systems. And one of my points that I make on the arcology is that, for instance, if Phoenix needs, I don't know how many policemen, suppose there are 500 policemen patrolling Phoenix physically, well, in an arcology of the equivalent size, probably you will need 50. This means that your police force is going to become less bureaucratically inclined, is going to be more effective, is going to be known better by the by the population, because it's
and
easier
the police
to know.
Will also know the population.
That's
better.
Right. So that this goes for any kind of service for the city: garbage collection, mail delivery, all sorts of delivery of foodstuff or any kind of hardware or software. And this means really the shrinking of the bureaucratic machinery to a fraction of what it is. And this is absolutely central to the humaneness of any kind of system.
Over the years, we've seen the United States government, and, you know, without any political inference of any kind, it has become less responsive and less responsive and less responsive mm-hmm. to the people. And I think that, to me, it's not a case of maliciousness so much as it's a case of there's really no other choice the way the way conditions mm-hmm. are at this particular mm-hmm. time. And I think that from that standpoint, you would make government, whether it be city or regardless of, you know, what scale you want to take it on, it would be much more responsive to citizens.
I think so, because it would be more, the challenges coming up would the feedbacks would be quicker, and the channels to go through would be shorter, so that everything would become more more attuned to the needs. Which is, again, it's very well exemplified by any animal structure, by any biological system, where you see that any challenge that comes is swiftly recorded, and the response comes, and most of the time the response is at the right scale, at the right moment, with the right polarization, the right kind of response. When the animal becomes too big, and the dinosaur might be a good example, a very popular example, the animal becomes sluggish because you lose a foot, and it takes 5 minutes to find out that you have lost a foot.
Right.
By then, your blood is gone, and you die off, which is very much what's happening in our big cities.
Now, the government, it seems that a lot of times the government either under-responds or over-responds. A lot of times you see the government use what I call overkill, and I don't mean it in this in the literal mm-hmm. sense of the word, but it's overkill. They use five times maybe the energy that they need to take care of a specific problem, mm-hmm. whereas if they had that problem right there at their fingertips, then they would know that they would need that exertion mm-hmm. of force that, mm-hmm. that they display.
And then there are very mechanical aspects which are also very fundamental. One, for instance, is the traffic that we are now using computers to make the red lights, you know, to synchronize them and so on. Well, the more, again, you can reduce the size of those things, the more effectiveness you're going to have in the production of swiftness and flow.
A lot of people talking, particularly concerning the ecology and the state that the world's in, and a lot of people seem to give us no hope whatsoever as far as working out mm-hmm. these what really monumental problems that we face now. Do you feel that way? All of your
Yes.
All of your theories to me seem to be mm-hmm. of a very positive nature, and not mm-hmm. not preaching negativism. And I was wondering, do you feel that we can do we have a good chance of working our way out of this?
I think so. Life is a very tough, very improbable, but very tough kind of phenomenon, and I think we're going to succeed. But we must, I think, face the fact that the environment is going to be taken care of, and with environment, mankind, only if we approach the environmental problem in one way, reverentially. If you approach it in a coercive way, we're only going to get some results. If you're going to approach it only through self-interest, you're going to get some results, but definitely not enough results. Only by reverently facing it, in other words, do it out of love, we are going to get answers. So what we have to do is to produce lovable centers where people are really willing to be there because they love it. And that's, I think that's the only answer that has a future.
Well, we didn't get to cover one-tenth of what I hope to cover, and I mean that sincerely. I would like to have you back on, perhaps a few months later when you have continued construction on your town, and maybe you could give us a sort of a progress report and cover some of it, because we didn't even get into that as much as I wanted to. But
that's nice of you to say that.
I would really like for you to come back, perhaps at the first of next year, and talk about it some with us.
Good.
If you could. And I have thoroughly enjoyed having you here. I mean that.
Thank you very much.
I would like to say one thing. If you are as dissatisfied as I am over the sketchy way we've covered things today, I would like to remind you that tomorrow night, Mr. Solari will be giving an illustrated lecture in open forum at the Phoenix Art Museum Auditorium. And I forget exactly, the Singer Auditorium, that's what it's called, or something like that.
It's in the museum, I don't know the name.
But it is in the Phoenix Art Museum, which is located at Central and McDowell. And if perhaps your interest has been pricked a little bit by the interview tonight, or if we left some questions unanswered in your mind, we would like to invite you up there tomorrow night. It will be at 7:30, and it's going to include slides of, I suppose, the new city that's coming up and some of your ideas.
Yeah. Plus slides of the buildings we have and slides of the work that I've been doing, including the building that we are beginning now.
And also at the end of that, then you'll have a question and answer session where if people wanted to sing questions at you like I've been doing tonight, then they could do so, right?
Yes.
All right, good. So that's tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Phoenix Art Museum in the auditorium there at Central and McDowell. And admission is free to the public, and we would like to invite you to perhaps go up and get answers to any of the unanswered questions. And once again, I want to remind you of the fact that Paolo Solari's exhibition is now at the Phoenix Art Museum. And I saw it today. It's well worth going to see. And it's something that I hope everybody in the Valley will get an opportunity to look at before it leaves. And that will be November the 7th. It will be running through that time. And we need to put in one thing. This is Paolo and his wife always want us to tell you this so that you won't get mad at them when you go up there and find it out. Admission is $1 for adults and 50 cents for students, which I don't think is the least bit outrageous. And thank you again.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed it. We have been talking to Paolo Solari, archaeologist, for the last hour and a half about some of his ideas. And we do want to remind you that tomorrow night on Forum, we'll be talking to a couple of the people from People for Peace, which is a high school peace organization. And one of the most active high school organizations in the city. We'll be talking to Brad Scaff and Mike McNellis and some other goodies later on in the week. This has been Bill Compton. You're listening to Forum. You've been listening to Forum. Heard Monday through Friday nights at 7 o'clock on KDKB FM Stereo in Mesa.